Well, here we are again, and I am delighted to be here. I've really enjoyed this classes day after day. I feel it gives us, almost all of you have been here every day. Some of you are new, and it's nice to see you. It's nice to be able to build both a vibration and an understanding together. For the few of you who are new here tonight, I am Naya Swami Asha. My home for the last so many years has been in the Ananda Ashram in Palo Alto, California, which my husband and I have developed over the last, actually, 25 years. Prior to that, I lived at Ananda's original community up in the foothills of the Nevada, Sierra Nevada in California. So it's been some four decades of dedication to this path, every day of which has been wonderful. Not always happy, but wonderful. There's a difference, and it's worth noting. Okay. There hasn't been one day that I haven't been grateful for the path that we're on and the truths that it gives us. So I'm traveling in India for 2 months now, sharing these teachings. Swami Kriyananda has suggested that for the next 25 years of my life, if it lasts that long, I think more globally and less locally. So I've begun this traveling to see what to do. Just for the sake of you who would like to know, the reason we have the camera here is that everything that I do, mostly, wherever I am, is either audio or video recorded, for the simple reason that with the internet these days, everything can just last and go on and on. So if you Google my name, Naya Swami Asha, you'll come to a website that's just www.nayaswamiasha.org, and then you can find not only the classes that we're giving here, which eventually come up, but also many, many other classes on all the topics that we've covered tonight and many others. I'm not the only one from Ananda who records and speaks, but you'll find a wealth of information there. Because the nature of everything I'm talking about is to provide you the incentive to want to go deeper. Once you have the incentive and the understanding that what you're looking for can be found through these teachings, there's a lot more to learn. So there's no pretense, and don't misunderstand yourselves, that just the inspiration and the few ideas that are offered tonight are the end of the story. They're really the beginning of the story. But certainly what I found and what I was referring to in the last 40-some years that I've been on this path, it's worth it. Because the alternative is the same life, but without any sense of direction. And just that sense of direction. Many years ago, if you'll excuse me, I'm just going to follow the Indian custom and not wear shoes up here. Somehow my shoes are in my way. Okay. Yeah, a little air would be nice. Somehow I get very hot speaking. It's a little hard on me. Okay. There's nothing. It's all right. I think it's okay because it makes a lot of noise, and the noise comes out on the microphone. It's hard enough to hear me. Thank you, Katyani. I appreciate that. I think just shedding my shoes will be enough. Many years ago at Ananda Village, which is a remote country ashram and is a bit unusual in America, we had a reporter come to do a story. Reporters like dramatic things. Their stories are more interesting if there's something dramatic. And we do live there, a little isolated from the society around us. We're a village. We're a complete society in ourselves, our own businesses, our own schools. We interact a great deal with the local area, but still we have a self-sustaining community there. So this reporter came, and I was hosting him as it happened, and I took him over to Swami Kriyananda's house for lunch. And we were sitting and having lunch, and he was an ordinary worldly man. And Swami Kriyananda asked him, you know, what do you think about the community? And he was between pleased and disappointed when he said, I expected it to be more exotic. You know, he expected not to see ordinary people dressed in ordinary clothes. I mean, at that time, even we didn't have as many brahmacharis or nayaswamis, so there was no even color costume. People were just walking around looking like ordinary people. He'd sort of hope that we would have strange robes on and have strange greetings and, you know, do things that would look a little weird, so his story would be better. And Swami Kriyananda just sort of casually said, yes, he said, we live just as other people live, except we put God first. And then he didn't really explain past that, and the reporter, frankly, did not have any idea what that meant. He didn't understand that that was the complete revolution that is Ananda, and that it wasn't necessary to have secret handshakes and strange headdresses and all of those things. Because when you put God first, you have completely reoriented your life. Now, the topic tonight is how to have courage, confidence, and calmness. And the answer to it is exactly the answer that Swami Kriyananda gave. You have to put God first. And I will not just end it there, as Swami did, because we're not having a lunch table conversation. We're having an hour discourse here with questions and answers at the end. So there's more to be said to that. But it is really, finally, the actual and only answer. But just as that reporter didn't quite grasp what that meant, you know, all of us, it's a lifelong project to really understand what that means. First, you have to understand it even as an idea, and then, much more profoundly, you have to understand it as an experience. What I have personally loved about being part of Ananda, I found Swami when I was 22 years old. I met him. I've explained some of this earlier, so I won't go over all of it. I discovered the teachings of self-realization when I was 18. So I really had virtually no life without this, although those first 18 years seemed really long to me at the time. But even at that young age, I felt like I had run through a lot of life options quickly. I never embroiled myself in any of them, but they sort of rose and fell from my life quickly. And when I embraced the path of Paramhansa Yogananda through Swami Kriyananda, I didn't know how long it would last. I have a very quick mind and have had a restless character, less so now. But what has been so astonishing to me is the deeper I get into it, the farther in front of me it expands. I've mentioned to you I was born in El Paso, Texas. Those of you who aren't from America don't necessarily know, Texas is this gigantic state, huge state, with enormous open spaces in it. And where I was born in extreme West Texas, there was a great deal of sandy desert, just miles and miles of sandy desert. To get from the town where we lived pretty much to anywhere, you had to drive for at least a couple of hours through this sandy desert. I must have had some karmic memory of living as a hermit in such a place because I always really enjoyed the desert. But there was a phenomenon when you drive across an open area like that with a bright sun and no landmarks, this water mirage forms on the highway. And it looks like the highway is wet and you're just about to get to the water and it goes off in front of you. And as a little child, the children in our family, we used to urge my father to drive faster and faster to see if we could catch it. And he would oblige us by trying to speed up. But of course it was a visual illusion and you could never catch it. In a very real sense, that image has always stayed with me on the spiritual path in a positive way. Whenever one thinks one has reached the edge of what this has to give you, it just dematerializes in front of you and expands out. It's like a magic creature that just promises you more and more and more. And so you can entertain yourself and fascinate yourself and challenge yourself literally endlessly. And if one doesn't, really one can hold no one responsible but oneself. In fact, not everyone remains fresh and dedicated on the path for a lifetime because we have to keep giving energy to it. You know, nothing feeds us by itself unless we also give energy to it. That's the great folly of materialism, is that we expect inanimate objects to love us back. We love them and we expect them to give us energy. We put a new carpet in our apartment once and it was a big deal to get the right color, to get the right price, to get it ordered, everything like that. We finally, after tremendous amount of hassle, laid the carpet. All the furniture is gone, the whole carpet is there. I'm alone in the house, and I stretched out on the new carpet. That's what you would do. And I tried to get energy from it, you know? And no matter how much I liked it, it was completely indifferent to me. It was a very dramatic example to me of the folly of just hoping for any kind of satisfaction from something that does not have consciousness. The fact is, when we devote ourselves to the divine, this is not an imaginary or an inert reality. There's an actual power there, and that power will give back to us. In fact, it is that power that gives back to us through anything in this life that we actually enjoy. We think it's other people, we think it's circumstances, we think it's a beautiful place to live. We have all these ideas about what it is, but actually all that's ever activating is our own potential for happiness, our own potential for satisfaction, for courage, for understanding, is being activated because we have this thought in our mind that there's a cause and effect here. It's very much like the light that, the concept of reflected light. If you have something that's made out of tin foil or tin in front of you and you shine light at it, it will reflect the light back to you. And you will have the illusion that the light is emanating from that which is reflecting back to you. But the truth of the matter is that the light is being shone upon it, whether the divine light is shining upon everything in this world, and those things that appear attractive to us are because of the prejudice of our mind to imagine that this way of life, this situation, you know, this circumstance is shining, and so we reach for it. You know, little tiny children, I was with a friend of mine when their baby girl was born. And just for a few moments at the very, you know, first seconds of her life, she seemed to have a little respiratory distress. It turned out to be nothing, but they picked up the child and took the child away from the mother in order just to make sure that she was okay. But the father went with her. And I went with the father and the baby. And the father, who's a very big man, it just made the scene more poignant because he's so big. And he was leaning over this little tiny baby. She was maybe a minute and a half old. She immediately reaches up and grabs his hand. And, you know, she had these tiny little hands and she wrapped it around one of his fingers. And of course it was, you know, absolutely as touching as it could possibly be to see the two of them there like that. But I was also so impressed. First thing she does in the world is she reaches out for something that she thinks is attractive. I mean, that's the way we're made. We don't understand that it only looks attractive to us because we are radiating the light toward it. Now, if we ever in our lives want to be able to move through this world with courage, calmness, and confidence, the only possible way to do that is to make an unshakable relationship with our unchanging inner reality and to recognize that whether it's reflecting light or reflecting darkness to us, that it is not, nothing around us is the source of our experience. It merely activates within us the vibration of consciousness that we're inclined to be on. Now, that's a very challenging teaching because, well, I'm looking out and I know that some of you have spoken to me about some of the difficult situations you face in your life. And it's very difficult to say that those are happy circumstances. People are suffering. People are making choices that you wish they weren't making. Seemingly innocent souls are being caught in the maelstrom of other people's decisions. There's no doubt all of that is happening. So it's not as if we have this silly point of view that some people try to get into, where they say, oh, everything is happening for the best. It's all just fine. It's all right. When America was attacked on September 11th, there were some people who said, oh, well, we really shouldn't be angry at the people who blew up the World Trade Center. We should just love the terrorists. Swami Kriyananda was like this about it. He said if a mad dog attacks your village, you know, you have to cage that mad dog. You can't just say, oh, nice puppy. You know, that an appropriate response to the circumstances of your life is not the same as an angry one or a frightened one. And those are the differences that we have to make. And part of true courage is to be able to actually perceive reality as it is. Sometimes our fear of actually looking at what's happening causes us to try to make things prettier than they are, because if they're not that pretty, then we're really going to have to deal with what's really happening. There was a time in the history of our community, Ananda Sangha, in America, where we start churches a lot, this is a uniquely American phenomenon where you can start religions. Our friends from Italy were visiting us when in our community, the temple that we have used to belong to the Catholic Church. But this is the secret they don't tell. They didn't have enough priests to keep all their churches going, so they made a business decision and sold off one of their churches. So my Italian friends are sitting at the table, and we're talking about buying a Catholic church. They were so bewildered. They start talking to each other in Italian. It was just incomprehensible to them that the church, which to them is just this monolithic thing, would actually sell off one of its buildings. It just didn't make any sense to them. But the point is, in America, these things happen. And you have usually you have the first church that's founded on certain principles, then you have the second church, then you have the third church. Well, Ananda is the second church of self-realization. And the other thing that happens in America is that the first church usually tries to snuff out the second church, because the first church wants the monopoly. This is a long story, only to say this. Ananda went through 12 years of being sued by the first church of self-realization in an attempt to not have a second church of self-realization. It was a very difficult period of time, because the people who were attacking us in the courts were Gurubais. So it was very, very confusing. And it was very interesting to me to watch how difficult it was for many people to look right in the face of something that's dark and difficult and just say, this is dark and difficult. Just say, this is happening. And a lot of the time that when we're unable to cope with the circumstances of our lives, it's because we just don't have the nerve to say, this is really happening. This person is really, you know, out to get me. This person is really evil. This person is really that unconscious that they're going to keep on in this hateful direction. So the first kind of courage that we need is just simply to perceive reality as it is. Now, the only way we can really perceive reality as it is if we really do perceive reality as it actually is, which is not what it seems. This is what we were talking about yesterday, but that we're in this process, all of us, which is this process of ever-expanding consciousness. And if we live our lives not so much on the this is going right, this is going wrong, these people are being good, these people are happy, these people are sad, but these are the classrooms that we're passing through. Nobody who takes a chemistry class or a calculus class or a physics class or a class in the German language really imagines that classroom is their life. You go through those studies because it gives you the tools you need to really move forward to the places that you really want to go. In the truest sense, every one of these experiences, we're having a classroom in the disappointment of a failed marriage. We're having a classroom in the fact that the marriage never happened at all. We're having a classroom in the death of a loved one. We're having a classroom in an inability to earn as much money as I think I need in my life. And what saps our strength is when we don't understand why it's happening. Now, of course, it's not possible always to be able to make a list like this. But as I was saying yesterday, first thing we have to understand is the reason it's happening is because look how much it upsets me, which in and of itself is just a perfect answer. At the beginning, last night was our class on karma, and I didn't really say this, but I'll say the thought now. At the beginning, we get very interested in all the details of our own present and past life. We're fascinated by ourselves. That's why astrologers and tarot card readers and psychics and past life readers and even the Brighu readers and the Agastya readers, we're all interested in it because they give us all this information about me. And I know all this stuff about me. It's very interesting then. But after a while, the only word I can think of is boredom about the details about me. Yes, sometimes it can be useful, and I myself have sought assistance from people who have that kind of expanded sight on occasion because I just found circumstances too bewildering and I wanted somebody to give me a little bit more of a map. But at a certain point, everything that happens is just a test of our courage and our calmness. And the details of it, they're really, it's like it's all the same. It's just something has happened that has upset me, and now I get to practice. It's like if you're in the gym, which I rarely go to, but I have gone to, and they have those bars that you lift, and they have those big round things that you put onto the end of them. And you know, there's 25 and 50, and then men lift them all up. It would be as if, and they make really big noise while they do it. It's very impressive. I did not find it as much fun as they did. I stopped going. But those weights only matter because they're the appropriate challenge. You know, the men don't stand there and think, oh, this 25-pound weight is more attractive than this 25-pound weight, and this 10-pound weight is the cutest little 10-pound weight, and this one over here. They just put the appropriate weight for them to be able to have the appropriate challenge, so that at the end of the time in the gym, they'll be stronger than when they walked in. And it would be ridiculous to waste your gym membership just putting on the end of those sticks things that you could just lift like that. Because you'd go in and out and feel really mighty and then walk out exactly the same as you walked in. But we behave about our incarnation sometimes as if it's a gym membership that we're wasting, don't we? We don't want too much weight on those bars, or we hassle and worry about the weights instead of just really using the moment to become stronger. Your spiritual life, your personal life becomes in an interesting way simpler and simpler because, oh look, this upsets me. And then we begin to think, to try to unravel, if necessary, the reasons why it upsets us, or even more deliberately, we don't even care why it upsets us. It just means that I have to lift my energy to a higher level. I had a very difficult number of years that I went through when I was writing this book, Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, which is a collection of stories of my own and others of how Swami Kriyananda has affected people in their lives. I love this book because I love the subject. And I think I did as good a job as I could in writing it. But it was not an easy project for me because I didn't know how to write at that point. I had a natural inclination for it, but I had a lot of, the word is karmic blocks. And so for a couple of years, I just made an effort to write it, and then literally, at the end of a couple of years, I didn't have anything. I had not one usable sentence, and I had, you know, made this huge deal about pulling back from all my other responsibilities to write this book, and I was just going in circles. Friends reassured me, you know, a couple of friends told me, I too, you know, took a sabbatical from work to write a book, and I never wrote a book, but that was small compensation to me. But what I understood was that the reason I was unable to write it was because I had certain emotional relationship to writing. Strange, now it's all behind me, so I don't understand. But at the time, it was intensely real. But my incentive, at one point, Swami Kriyananda, who has a perfect understanding of my psychology, said, look, this doesn't seem to be working. Why don't you just give it up? Why don't you just quit? So all of a sudden I had his permission to quit. So I stood back from that a little bit and reflected on it, and I realized that the only reason I wasn't able to write it was because of karmic issues in my own life, and if I stopped, I would just have to meet those issues again later. That they were within my chakras, they were not being caused by anything external. It was the right challenge for my equanimity and my ability to rise above it. And the last thing I wanted to do was to do it again. That's a really powerful incentive when you find yourself losing courage in the face of a really challenging situation. This is terrible. Do I want to do it again? And that alone was enough for me to just keep going until just one glorious day. Well, I'll give my husband the credit. From the very beginning, he kept quietly saying to me, "Why don't you just write stories?" And I kept sort of spinning. And then, you know, every 6 months or so, he would say, "Why don't you just write stories?" And after about 2 or 3 years, I said, "Hey, I could just write stories." I am very concentrated and creative in short bursts. So I actually have just recently published another book of stories, which I'll hold up and talk to you about in a moment. Works great for me, because I can just really concentrate for a short period of time and then burst out of it, and that works. Why don't you just write stories? But the main thing that happened is, as I said to Swamiji, except for the fact that I haven't a single usable sentence, this has been one of the greatest spiritual experiences of my life, to just fail completely. I'm not used to failing. Fail completely, fail publicly, you know, fail hopelessly, and just keep on going. Just persevere, persevere, persevere. It's something, because that's all that God is really asking of us. There's this remark is credited to Paramahansa Yogananda. I don't know if I've ever heard Swami Kriyananda say it. That's why I say it tentatively. If he didn't say it, he might have. And this was what he said. He said, "You don't have to pass your tests gloriously standing up and striding across the finish line." He said, "You don't even have to walk across." He said, "You can be on your belly just slithering forward." And as long as you don't quit, that's the only thing that counts. A lot of time we lose courage in the face of our difficulties because we truly have a wrong idea of what courage looks like. You know, merely not to give up. I've learned, I'm old enough now, I can really appreciate that if you simply keep putting one foot in front of the other, the power of the universe will take you across that finish line as long as you don't quit. Perseverance. Now, the one interesting fact that anybody looking at life can perceive very easily is that nothing in this world stays the same, that all circumstances are constantly shifting. And when we're tuned in to life as an experience of growth, then we perceive each of those changes as an opportunity for us to learn something new. Strangely enough, the human consciousness, you know, well, let me put it more accurately. There's essentially three levels of consciousness that exist simultaneously. There is what we think of as the subconscious, and that's not the subconscious that Jung talked about. It's not the sort of some universal source of anything. By subconscious, it just means all those experiences and thoughts and feelings that we have gathered in, not only from this incarnation, but from all the incarnations that have come before. This is what's stored in the chakras, the karma that I was talking about yesterday. In a sense, our subconscious is all the karma that we've accumulated until now. But what it also is, it's everything that we've already done and accomplished. You know, all of us sitting here, it's fascinating. I'm looking at your faces, and everybody looks a little different. That, as Swamiji says, two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. Amazing how creative God is with it, isn't it? Every single one of you is recognizable as a unique individual. Even identical twins can be told apart if you look at them closely. Because each of us has accomplished a certain amount, had a certain number of experiences, which have brought us right to this point. And so all of that is our subconscious, because it's in the past and it's brought us to where we are now. There's nothing new happening from the subconscious because it's already there. It's not being recreated in any way at all. The experiences we have, we put there. It's like the memory in our computers. It just is what it is. And there's a principle in the computer programming: if you put garbage into it, then you get garbage out of it. But I think my computer is a conscious being that takes vengeance on me periodically. But my wiser friends assure me that it's completely impersonal. To a certain extent, our subconscious is completely impersonal. However we've programmed it, that's how it responds. On the other side, we have the level that we call the superconscious. And this is where our limited, identified with the body, which is our ego self, meets our own infinite potential. It's in the superconsciousness that our true expansion takes place. Now, we're always being pulled, just in the same way that the river is being pulled to the sea. The image of the river being pulled to the sea is so dynamic for understanding the soul's progress. Someone wrote to me and asked once, when does the soul begin to seek God? And I said, when does the river begin to flow to the ocean? As soon as it comes out of the ground, as soon as the spring rises from the ground, it heads for the sea. And somehow it knows. And no matter what ups and downs it goes through, no matter how it turns away, eventually it turns back. All rivers flow to the sea. And so we, in our superconscious self, because of our own desire for bliss and our own inability to be satisfied until that perfect bliss is attained, we're always being drawn into the superconscious. The superconscious is the source of all creativity and all new inspirations, and it's from higher realms that these sources come to us. Any of you who have done creative work, now that I have learned to write, I now understand, you begin to work and the inspiration comes to you. You don't have to be an artist. You get it when you're cooking. You know that the soup needs more basil or something like that. You can just feel it. The idea comes to you that this is what needs to happen. And whenever we feel that flow of inspiration, we're attuned to the superconscious. Now, the conscious mind, the conscious level of reality, is the third level. But interestingly, the conscious level doesn't really exist as an independent reality. The conscious mind is simply the battleground between these two forces. And it's the field of Kurukshetra. It's our own consciousness. That's where the battle of Kurukshetra takes place, the conscious level. Everything that we've been in the past, that we're comfortable with, that's familiar, that is the self-identification that we've built up over a really long time, pulls at us and tries to keep us there. Oh, but you're a woman alone, you can't do this. I was walking from my hotel to the planetarium today, and, you know, I was conscious of the fact that I was a foreign woman alone on the streets of Calcutta, and there were all these different people crowding around me, and, you know, just that tiny thought crosses my mind, and then I think, no, I'm not. You know, I appear to be that, but I'm not that at all. I'm just a little bubble in the sea, just moving through among other bubbles. We don't have to always be grabbed by all those subconscious definitions. We can walk and live and move in a completely different state of consciousness, in freedom. You know, the anxiety of a woman traveling alone, you know, can cross your mind. That's a subconscious reality. But from the superconscious comes a completely different thought. Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru. You know, it's not noisy, it's not crowded, it's not a place that I don't know. There's all the different ways that you can identify, and the conscious mind is the battleground in which that happens. When I was making an effort to write that book, one of the difficulties I had is that I used to have a fairly critical nature. And so every time I would write a sentence, I would criticize it. You can't both create and criticize simultaneously. But all the criticism I had ever offered out in my life was right there in my subconscious mind, and every time I tried to do something creative, it told me that it was no good, just like that. So we just sort of did that for a long time. And I wasn't even aware of the battle for a long while. I just thought everything I wrote was bad because my subconscious kept behaving the way it had always behaved. And then one day, I finally realized, well, the way I actually solved that problem was not only was that I listened to my husband, but also I realized, and this was great fun, that I was the only one in the entire world of Ananda who didn't believe I could write that book. Everyone else knew that I could write it, including Swami. And I finally thought, what an egoic position to be in, to be holding my point of view against everybody else. Now, that's a very key element in this battle between superconscious and subconscious, and I want to talk about that right now. One of the songs that Dutti and the other musicians sang for you is the Dare to be Different song, Dare to be Free, and, you know, stand up and call your soul your own. These are very powerful songs with an extremely important message. Well, walking through the sidewalks of Calcutta today, I knew that most of those people weren't coming to my class tonight. Most of those people had no idea that I was teaching. Most of those people would not be interested in the fact that I was teaching. They were all just doing something else. And many of them, I could see last night, this beggar boy came up to our taxi. Unfortunately, all I had was a 1,000-rupee note, which, even though I really liked him, was a little more than I was going to give him. But I really wanted to give him something. He was about 6. He was the most dynamic, creative little beggar I have ever seen. He played rhythms on your taxi window, and he just sort of, he was really a creative beggar, really a hustler of a beggar. And I really wanted to reward him. I don't think he's going to stay there for the rest of his life. But you could see in his eyes and with his force, you know, he's distinguishing himself from everyone else with his own creative determination. And all the people on the streets, because it's difficult in this city for a lot of people to just make their way on a most fundamental level, people are struggling to distinguish themselves, to have enough power within them to rise above all the circumstances of their life. Now, that continues all the way through, and that is the appropriate response to challenge for a long time, is to build your own personal strength. And at a certain point, as I've been talking in these classes until now, it occurs to a person that the conventional answers that have been offered to us are not necessarily true. Speaking of my own childhood, I was born with that thought and completely confused because nobody around me seemed to be asking the questions I wanted to ask or giving me the answers. And I matriculated at Stanford University and lost interest in about 2 weeks. You know, it's a big university. I always like to say that just so I can just say it. I went to Stanford for 2 weeks. I actually went for a whole year, but I dropped out mentally in 2 weeks because they were just still, nobody was thinking outside the convention that to me already looked utterly unfulfilling. And they didn't have what to my mind was the essential originality to question on the level that I felt it needed to be questioned. So before we get to the spiritual path, we generally have to build up a certain amount of reliance upon our own point of view, which is more egoically based than divinely based, just so that we can answer the question properly, what should I be doing with my life, and come up with a creative answer that is not just the conventional answer. So what happens is we get a certain appropriate reliance on our own ability to think and to know. And all that builds up in our subconscious mind. And we're standing here at this point of hard work to have enough power to say, I know what I ought to do. But then what happens is we hit the wall on that. Because as long as that I is defined in terms of the subconscious reality, I'm educated, I've proven myself, I'm a good business person, we can even say my intuition has guided me properly, whatever it might be, we reach the point where exactly the opposite thing is now needed from us. We have to realize that the limit of this individuality now has to be turned into receptivity from a higher source. And that's the transition point where we really begin to make God the center of our life. But the important factor you have to understand here is that all the strength that makes one able to stand strongly on your own two feet is what you bring to your receptivity. Swami Kriyananda says he never likes the word surrender, even though I've seen it even in his own writings, because generally when you surrender, you're backed up against the wall, you fought as hard as you can, nothing has worked, and you've been overpowered. That isn't, and implied in that is that as soon as you can escape, you're going to, you know? But the word we really want is self-offering. Or the word we want might be, the word I used a moment ago, receptivity. We actually realize that I have gathered all this force, and this is the subconscious, I've gathered all this force, I know what I think, I know who I am, I know what I want, and now I need help. I need real help. And we have to understand now our power comes from recognizing that even what brought us to here was actually an influx of energy from a higher source. And we begin to, well, the right word for it is we identify with a larger reality. Now, this is the interesting balance point about true spirituality, and this is what the masters really demonstrate for us, and what Swami Kriyananda, above all, has demonstrated so perfectly for us. It's very interesting. Most of the time, a master leaves very little tangible record of his life. But Yogananda was a creative artist. He wrote songs, he wrote poems, he wrote several books. And Swami Kriyananda has just carried that almost to an unbelievable degree with the amount of creativity that's flown through him. And he's so, whenever we comment to him how amazing it is, he just very calmly says, oh, anybody can do it. You just lift your consciousness to the spiritual eye and you ask God for what you want, and then there it is, it comes through you. And the fact that he describes it as so simple is very telling. Because what he's saying is that he's learned to gather all the energy that is him, but recognize that it's not really him at all, it's the divine flowing through him. Now, this is the source of calmness, confidence, and courage. Because as long as we have defined ourselves as being individually separate and personally responsible, there's always going to be a very deep level of insecurity, isn't there? Because no matter how clever, how talented, how famous, how anything we've become, the world is so much bigger than our capacity to control it, isn't it? You know, and sometimes, as I was talking about yesterday, sometimes it's a karmic bomb that goes off. You're just walking down the street and then you step on a karmic landmine and it just blows up in front of you. And it's strong enough to unsettle our sense of confidence in this world. Sometimes the most difficult things that happen to us are actually the greatest blessing in the end, because they tell us we can't do it ourselves. Now that is what Swami means when he says we live just like anyone else, but we put God first. Now, all of these ways of thinking are just habits of the mind. And this book, which I recommend all of these wisdom series books. This one in particular I recommend because there's a lot of really practical, specific teaching in here and techniques. And one of the primary techniques offered in here is the simple technique of affirmations. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how that works, because what we're trying to do in this fight between the conscious and the subconscious is we're trying to replace in our own minds a completely different definition of who we are and what we're doing. When I was going through those years of trying to extricate myself from the subconscious morass I had created that was blocking my ability to be creative, it was a complete crisis of confidence. And I realized that that crisis of confidence, it didn't really exist. It was a self-perpetuating myth. You know, when you sit to do something and fear thoughts overtake you, then those fear thoughts block your ability to do it. And so then look, you can't do it. But there's no inherent inability to function. There's just the repeating thought that you can't. And most of our thoughts are just, now let me phrase it like properly like this. The conscious mind is just the battleground. And if the subconscious is always feeding you something that is sucking your energy to go forward away, you need to turn and draw something from the superconscious side that simply drives the other thought out. You can only have, you know, one point of view at a time. And if you think, oh, I'm incapable, I'm afraid, okay, this is how Yogananda put it perfectly. It's an autobiography of a yogi. He said, we do not create our own thoughts. We merely receive them from the universe. There are an infinite number of possibilities of vibrations to tune into, and we simply tune into the one that we resonate with. If Jesus Christ or Yogananda walked into this room, he would see something very different than we're looking at. In fact, once Master was standing with Swami Kriyananda and other disciples, and he was in a very elevated state of consciousness, Yogananda was, and he was sharing that, and he said, if you could see yourselves as I see you, you would see that you are nothing but beautiful light, just beautiful light. Now, I see a lot of light in your eyes, but I'm still seeing all your bodies. I'm not seeing just that beautiful light. But to see the world as it is, we need to see the world as it really is, which is that none of this is really here. When Yogananda writes about his time with Master Mahasaya, the great devotee of Ramakrishna, and how the world looked to him. It always was just blissful and sweet because that was his vibration and those were the thoughts he attracted. Now we are all one with the infinite, and the infinite power is our potential at any moment. But if we are concentrating on our lack of that power, then we create a vibration that literally it just can't come through. That's what this world is. It's different vibrations. When we're singing in the choir and we get it just right and all our notes just meet, there's just this sense of complete unity of vibration. And if your note's a little off, you're kind of close, but you're going like that with each other. You're not quite coming in together. Now, we can influence the vibration of our consciousness so much more readily than we realize, because the conscious mind is just the battleground between these two forces, the whole battle of Kurukshetra. Which side are we on? When I was struggling with to write, I had to find for myself, now these are some of the keys about changing your thoughts. One of the reasons people have trouble changing their thoughts is they often try to take a step that's too big. In nature never makes sudden leaps. We had a little hyacinth growing on our windowsill. Somebody gave us a bulb, and the hyacinth bulb was there, and I knew, in fact, it will have become a hyacinth while I'm away. I knew eventually there would be a plant coming out of the top that would be a beautiful flower, but it started as just this bulb sitting in water, and then while I was still home, the little roots began to come out into the water. You could see the whole thing. This little tiny green shoot came, and no amount of desire on my part to have that turn into a flower before I left America was going to turn it into a flower, because it had to go through the stages it needed to go through to reach its full potential. And very often we find ourselves, you know, scarcely more than a bulb with a few roots down, but we know that the flower is what we want, so we think our affirmation is, I am a flower, I am a flower, I am a flower. We also like that affirmation because it saves us the trouble of having to go through the stages of the roots and the trouble of bringing that up. So a lot of times, an affirmation that's too big for us is just the subconscious mind convincing us that it's really too much work to become a flower. So I'm just going to sit back and affirm that I'm a flower. And then, whoa, I'm not a flower. I guess the system doesn't work. And then we get to go back here. A lot of times the mind is very, very subtle. So when we want to start moving in more in a superconscious direction, we have to take steps that we can actually believe in. If you make an affirmation that's too big for you, it actually weakens you, because your subconscious is so much stronger than that affirmation. If you're sitting there saying, I'm a flower, I'm a flower, I'm a flower, your subconscious mind, it says, not a chance. Not a chance. And every time you say, I'm a flower, it says, no, no. But if you say, look, the sprout is beginning to sprout. Look, look, the sprout is a little bigger today. I can grow a sprout. Then you're moving in the right direction, but you're moving it with a force that you can actually believe in. So there's the reason I hold up this book is full of specific ways to change your thoughts, specific word formulas for changing your thoughts. When I needed to start shifting my lack of confidence in my ability to write that book, this is the affirmation I came up with, and I'll explain to you why it worked, and this is how you should think about it for yourself. These were words from Yogananda, I didn't write them. I know God's power is limitless. Okay, in my own particular little world, nothing in me doubts that. I know God's power is limitless. So I can say that with my whole heart, and nobody is cutting the ground out from under me. The second line is, and as I am made in His image. Well, you know, sometimes I can question that, but nonetheless, I really do believe as I am made in His image. I know God's power is limitless, and as I am made in His image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. Now that one is a little dicier, you know, but I've trapped myself with the first two, and I'm philosophically honest. If God's power is limitless and I'm made in His image, then it's probably true that I do have the power within me to accomplish what I need to accomplish, to overcome all obstacles. Now, an affirmation like that, just simple that you can solidly believe in, becomes the replacement for all the rest of the chatter. And this is not an easy practice, but it sounds so simple, don't mistake how powerful it is. Because the conscious mind does not exist, it's just a battleground. And every time we give in to a thought that contradicts our superconscious potential, well, the Kauravas have won. The Kauravas have won the battle that day. The Pandavas have lost. But every time we can push those wrong thoughts out of our mind and simply replace them with a powerful alternative, it's not merely that that reality is pushed away, but suddenly we've tuned ourselves into a force on this side. God becomes the center and His power becomes the center. We are a river flowing to the sea. We swim upstream away from the ocean, and we work and work and work, and we look at the bank and we've made absolutely no progress. If you've ever swum against the current in a river, you know that just it's a complete hopeless task. As soon as you start swimming with the current, then all of a sudden all this force is moving with you. In the battle for courage and confidence, as soon as we start trying to draw our confidence from our divine potential and just simply surrender the belief that I can make it on my own, then suddenly the current takes us and eventually we become like Swami Kriyananda. Oh, just lift the idea up to the spiritual eye and God will give you the answer. And you can begin to find that just in the smallest way in your own life. I had a woman friend who was very talented, very good, very capable in every respect. She had one enormous flaw, and that flaw was self-doubt. No matter what began to happen with her, she would always become very anxious about her ability to deal with whatever she had to deal with. And also that made her energy extremely self-centered, and in every situation, instead of just being able to participate and give, she was always spinning this, what about me, what about me, what about me, which was completely a drain on everybody, including her. And I tried to talk to her about how to shift this. She was a woman who liked to go camping out in the woods a lot. I said, if you were out camping in the woods, and let's say where you were camping, there were rattlesnakes. I know here it's cobras and other things, but there it's rattlesnakes. Rattlesnake has fangs. And I said, and a rattlesnake came and sank his fangs into your wrist. I said, you wouldn't spend any time thinking about it. You wouldn't think, well, maybe this happened because I deserved it. You know, maybe it's because of the things I did before. maybe it's really right that I should be bitten by a rattlesnake. You would perceive it as a life and death emergency. You would try to get the rattlesnake off your body, and you would try to go put the antidote in as soon as possible. He said, you have to understand that every time in the Battle of Kurukshetra that you allow the Kauravas to persuade you that you are disconnected from the divine, that you don't have the power, that this task is greater than you can achieve, that who do you think you are trying to, you know, be better than these circumstances, it is a life and death emergency. And you need to keep the antiviral, the antivenom, right in your pocket at all times. When I was trying to shift myself from the deeply held conviction that this project was beyond me to the self-evident truth to everyone but me, that it wasn't, I know God's power is limitless, and as I am made in His image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. I said that so many times, I was sick of hearing it. I really was. But every time the fear would rise, every time the lack of confidence would rise, every time the lack of faith would rise, I would just counter it. If I had to say it out loud and it was appropriate, I would. If I could only say it mentally, concentrating on every single word, believing every single word. Yogananda says it's all a matter of how much you have committed yourself to the truth of what you're saying. I can't say strongly enough how deceptively simple this practice is compared to the effectiveness of it, because it's simply changing the vibration that you live on. And when you extricate yourself from that negative and move yourself toward the positive, you are a completely different person, because we are nothing but the vibration that we channel. And the most evil person in the world, who's done the most terrible things, can become a great saint if he simply shifts the vibration that he channels. You see? What he's been channeling is to hurt and abuse other people, but he suddenly repents and realizes that this is terrible and becomes a servant of everyone, maybe only of the prisoners in the jail where he's spending the rest of his life. But whatever it might be, as soon as he makes that shift, think about it. That's who he is. There's absolutely nothing fixed about our reality, but we reinforce it. We reinforce it moment by moment by not realizing this truth that Yogananda put. I have many favorites, but this is one of my favorites. Take care of the minutes, he said. Take care of the minutes, and incarnations will take care of themselves, is how he said it. Because, see, part of what causes us to lose hope is that it looks so big, the rest of my life, all of my past lives, all of this karma that I'm carrying, you know, and I'm all, the chakras, the vrittis, the past lives, the bad deeds, you know, just like, it just goes on and on, the eternities of time. It's overwhelming. It is overwhelming. We tell you, do Kriya, and it'll make a huge difference, which it will. But the main thing is, in this minute, you know, as I am here, am I with the Kauravas? Am I with the Pandavas? That's why that whole story of the Mahabharata and the Gita is so powerful. Who is winning? The end of every day, you know, which side was I on? The fear of the welfare of the people I love comes up, and we say, I know God's power is limitless. Others that are just, the other one that I use a lot, I have on my computer. I'm not sure I can find it in this moment. I have within me the power and intelligence I need to meet all the problems of this day. That's just a very good one. I have within me the power and intelligence, all that I need to meet all the problems of this day. Very little tiny affirmation, isn't it? I shall live today in perfect faith, calling on this power as the need arises. Yogananda is so simple in the way he puts it. I have the power within me to deal with today, and when the problems arise, I will use that power. Now, just think, in the moment, if you have programmed your mind, programmed your subconscious, programmed your conscious just to be thinking like that, the problem arises. And instead of falling into, oh, what am I going to do? Oh, no. I have within me all the intelligence and power needed to solve this problem, and I will call on that power to solve it. Everything, 100% is different when you really have that deep within you. When I would say this affirmation, don't think that this is magic. If you say, I have within me all the power and intelligence to deal with the problems of today, when they come, I'll just deal with it, I'll call on it. That's your subconscious mind saying, you know, this is a magic potion. It's not a magic potion. I said to my, I would swim often. I use swimming. I don't go to the gym, but I go to the swimming pool, and I use swimming because I discovered the physiological element between the physiological element of stress. And I realized that when I went swimming, when I exercised, I could interrupt the physiological process of stress, because stress has an element that you can interrupt with exercise. So I would swim back and forth. I know God's power is limitless, and as I am made in His image, I too have the strength. Just back and forth and back and forth. But fascinatingly, every single word. I'll tell you another story. This is not about affirmation, but this is about the power of habit, and then I'll stop for questions. There was a crisis in my family at one point, and it involved the hospital, and it involved a lot of really painful experiences that were completely out of my control. I just was, I'm very good in other people's crises. That's one of my strengths. I get very calm when it's other people's problems. So I was there trying to help it, but I was going down. It was so painful. Everybody was suffering so much, and I couldn't do anything to stop it. But I had to maintain myself in the public view. So I, at one point, went out to my car in the parking lot, and I just came to pieces because I was all by myself. I'm sure that a lot of people have come to pieces inside their cars, outside of hospitals, right? So I was just so upset. And this voice, I go like this because it came in my right ear and seemed to go out my left ear. It went right through my brain. And it said, do you think this could possibly be happening outside the will of God? And I was like, I was so annoyed because I was really being upset. And all of a sudden, my capacity to have a tantrum was being interrupted by this philosophical thought. But I was trapped. I was trapped by the fact that I'd spent years of my life, practicing when it was easier. Remember I mentioned that earlier? Just trying to feel God's will, God's presence behind everything that happened. So all of a sudden, I was in this huge crisis. And my own subconscious, in that case, subconscious, superconscious, came in and said, what are you so upset about? Do you really think that this is happening outside the will of God? And I just had to stop. I went completely calm. And I thought, oh, if this is happening, if this is the will of God, what's the more appropriate response to it? So I'll give you another tool that's really helpful. Yogananda says we should not be formal with God. God is our father, God is our mother. If you're talking to your father or your mother, you show them your whole heart. You don't come with a formal petition that you've written out and present it like that. You just throw yourself on the mercy of their love for you. So I said, all right, Lord, if this is indeed your will, I want you to understand I don't like it. And furthermore, I am just losing the capacity to cope. And if you're trying this is and this became my affirmation. Whatever it is you're trying to teach these people, you really need to help them learn it. And later, when I was dealing with my parents in the last of their lives, my prayer became, Divine Mother, give them the wisdom, the receptivity, the devotion, and the strength to learn whatever it is you want them to learn. And then I was able to put so much power behind that prayer because it just matched everything. And I was also, it was a real demand of God because it was my survival at stake too. Whatever it is that you're trying to teach them, give them the wisdom, the devotion, the receptivity, and the power to learn it. And then I would often add, and make it happen fast. But you see, this is putting God at the center. We live just like everyone else lives, except we put God at the center. And I suddenly realized, heavens, I'm not in charge of this. whoever, I mean, yes, I'm trying to help them, but what is this business of I have to maintain and make it all work for everyone? What could I have been thinking? You know, that's what got us to this point, but this is not, that's not what'll take us forward. I went back in and everything shifted in the circumstances that I was in. I mean, nobody got better immediately, but everything shifted. It was like the whole thing had been set up just to bring me to that point, and as soon as I shifted my energy, then we're a solar system with everyone else. Somebody's gravitational field shifts, everybody shifts. But that was really so dynamic. We live just like everyone else lives, but we put God at the center. And if we find ourselves anxious and afraid, by definition, we do not have God at the center. The prayer may be, Lord, I'm going down, you need to give me strength. But still, that's putting God at the center, you see? And that's the only answer. I really want to also, I have two other things to recommend to you tonight. This is a book that I just finished. It's called Loved and Protected, and it's been published first in India. It's relevant, not merely, I'm not really just holding it up because I wrote it, although I'm real proud of it, so I am holding it up because I wrote it. That's all right. Much easier than I wrote the other one. But this is stories that I collected from all the people that I know mostly of miracles and answered prayers. And it's a kind of quiet book. It's very simple and easy to read. But when you finish reading it, you realize that you can call on God and God will answer. So if you feel inclined, this particular collection of stories is right in the heart of what we're talking about tonight. It's living like everyone else lives, but putting God first. And these stories range from life-saving to merely amusing, but all of them are the power of prayer and the power of God's response. And also, I never really touched on it much, but lessons in self-realization are the practices of Kriya Yoga and so on to change your consciousness. I never got there tonight. In 1 hour, I couldn't get there, but it's also part of it.